I asked. She inclined her head.
I give you my word.
He released her wrist. She added, not raising her head,
The only thing I'll say is that if they sentence you to jail tomorrow, I'll quit, without waiting for any destroyer to prompt me.
You won't. And I don't think they'll sentence me to jail. I think they'll let me off very lightly. I have a hypothesis about it. I'll explain it to you afterwards, when I've put it to the test.
What hypothesis?
Who is John Galt? He smiled and stood up. That's all. We won't talk any further about my trial tonight. You don't happen to have anything to drink in your office, have you?
No. But I think my traffic manager has some sort of a bar on one shelf of his filing closet.
Do you think you could steal a drink for me, if he doesn't have it locked?
I'll try.
He stood looking at the portrait of Nat Taggart on the wall of her office, the portrait of a young man with a lifted head, until she returned, bringing a bottle of brandy and two glasses. He filled the glasses in silence.
You know, Dagny, Thanksgiving was a holiday established by productive people to celebrate the success of their work.
The movement of his arm, as he raised his glass, went from the portrait, to her, to himself, to the buildings of the city beyond the window. For a month in advance, the people who filled the courtroom had been told by the press that they would see the man who was a greedy enemy of society. But they had come to see the man who had invented Reardon Metal. He stood up when the judges called upon him to do so. He wore a gray suit. He had pale blue eyes and blonde hair. It was not the colors that made his figure seem icily implacable. It was the fact that the suit had an expensive simplicity seldom flaunted these days, that it belonged in the sternly luxurious office of a rich corporation, that his bearing came from a civilized era and clashed with the place around him. The crowd knew from the newspapers that he represented the evil of ruthless wealth, and, as they praised the virtue of chastity, then ran to see any movie that displayed a half-naked female on its posters, so they came to see him. Evil, at least, did not have the stale hopelessness of a bromide which none believed and none dared to challenge. They looked at him without admiration. Admiration was a feeling they had lost the capacity to experience long ago. They looked with curiosity and with a dim sense of defiance against those who had told them that it was their duty to hate him. A few years ago they would have jeered at his air of self-confident wealth. But today there was a slate-gray sky in the windows of the courtroom which promised the first snowstorm of a long, hard winter. The last of the country's oil was vanishing, and the coal mines were not able to keep up with the hysterical scramble for winter supplies. The crowd in the courtroom remembered that this was the case which had cost them the services of Ken Daniger. There were rumors that the output of the Daniger Coal Company had fallen perceptibly within 1 month. The newspapers said that it was merely a matter of readjustment while Daniger's cousin was reorganizing the company he had taken over. Last week, the front pages had carried the story of a catastrophe on the site of a housing project under construction. Defective steel girders had collapsed, killing 4 workmen. The newspapers had not mentioned, but the crowd knew, that the girders had come from Orrin Boyle's Associated Steel. They sat in the courtroom in heavy silence, and they looked at the tall gray figure, not with hope. They were losing the capacity to hope, but with an impassive neutrality spiked by a faint question mark. The question mark was placed over all the pious slogans they had heard for years. The newspapers had snarled that the cause of the country's troubles, as this case demonstrated, was the selfish greed of rich industrialists, that it was men like Hank Reardon who were to blame for the shrinking diet, the falling temperature, and the cracking roofs in the homes of the nation. That if it had not been for men who broke regulations and hampered the government's plans, prosperity would have been achieved long ago, and that a man like Hank Reardon was prompted by nothing but the profit motive. This last was stated without explanation or elaboration, as if the words profit motive were the self-evident brand of ultimate evil. The crowd remembered that these same newspapers, less than 2 years ago, had screamed that the production of Reardon metal should be forbidden because its producer was endangering people's lives for the sake of his greed. They remembered that the man in gray had ridden in the cab of the first engine to run over a track of his own metal, and that he was now on trial for the greedy crime of withholding from the public a load of the metal which it had been his greedy crime to offer in the public market. According to the procedure established by directives, cases of this kind were not tried by a jury, but by a panel of three judges appointed by the Bureau of Economic Planning and Natural Resources. The procedure, the directives had stated, was to be informal and democratic. The judge's bench had been removed from the old Philadelphia courtroom for this occasion and replaced by a table on a wooden platform. It gave the room an atmosphere suggesting the kind of meeting where a presiding body puts something over on a mentally retarded membership. One of the judges, acting as prosecutor, had read the charges. "You may now offer whatever plea you wish to make in your own defense," he announced. Facing the platform, his voice inflectionless and peculiarly clear, Hank Reardon answered, "I have no defense." "Do you?" The judge stumbled. He had not expected it to be that easy. "Do you throw yourself upon the mercy of this court?" "I do not recognize this court's right to try me."
"What?"
"I do not recognize this court's right to try me."
"But, Mr. Reardon, this is the legally appointed court to try this particular category of crime."
"I do not recognize my action as a crime."
"But you have admitted that you have broken our regulations controlling the sale of your metal."
"I do not recognize your right to control the sale of my metal."
"Is it necessary for me to point out that your recognition was not required?"
"No. I am fully aware of it, and I am acting accordingly." He noted the stillness of the room. By the rules of the complicated pretense which all those people played for one another's benefit, they should have considered his stand as incomprehensible folly. There should have been rustles of astonishment and derision. There were none. They sat still. They understood.
"Do you mean that you are refusing to obey the law?" asked the judge.
"No, I am complying with the law, to the letter. Your law holds that my life, my work, and my property may be disposed of without my consent." "Very well. You may now dispose of me without my participation in the matter. I will not play the part of defending myself where no defense is possible, and I will not simulate the illusion of dealing with the tribunal of justice."
"But, Mr. Reardon, the law provides specifically that you are to be given an opportunity to present your side of the case and to defend yourself."
"A prisoner brought to trial can defend himself only if there is an objective principle of justice recognized by his judges, a principle upholding his rights, which they may not violate and which he can invoke. The law by which you are trying me holds that there are no principles, that I have no rights, and that you may do with me whatever you please." "Very well. Do it."
"Mr. Reardon, the law which you are denouncing is based on the highest principle, the principle of the public good."
"Who is the public? What does it hold as its good? There was a time when men believed that the good was a concept to be defined by a code of moral values, and that no man had the right to seek his good through the violation of the rights of another. If it is now believed that my fellow men may sacrifice me in any manner they please for the sake of whatever they deem to be their own good, if they believe that they may seize my property simply because they need it, well, so does any burglar. There is only this difference. The burglar does not ask me to sanction his act. A group of seats at the side of the courtroom was reserved for the prominent visitors who had come from New York to witness the trial. Dagny sat motionless, and her face showed nothing but a solemn attention, the attention of listening with the knowledge that the flow of his words would determine the course of her life. Eddie Willers sat beside her. James Taggart had not come. Paul Larkin sat hunched forward, his face thrust out, pointed like an animal's muzzle, sharpened by a look of fear now turning into malicious hatred. Mr. Moen, who sat beside him, was a man of greater innocence and smaller understanding. His fear was of a simpler nature. He listened in bewildered indignation, and he whispered to Larkin, "Good God, now he's done it. Now he'll convince the whole country that all businessmen are enemies of the public good." "Are we to understand," asked the judge, "that you hold your own interests above the interests of the public?" "I hold that such a question can never arise except in a society of cannibals."
What do you mean?"
"I hold that there is no clash of interests among men who do not demand the unearned and do not practice human sacrifices."
"Are we to understand that if the public deems it necessary to curtail your profits, you do not recognize its right to do so?"
"Why, yes, I do. The public may curtail my profits any time it wishes, by refusing to buy my product."
"We are speaking of other methods."
"Any other method of curtailing profits is the method of looters, and I recognize it as such."
"Mr. Reardon, this is hardly the way to defend yourself."
"I said that I would not defend myself."
"But this is unheard of. Do you realize the gravity of the charge against you?"
"I do not care to consider it."
"Do you realize the possible consequences of your stand?"
"Fully."
"It is the opinion of this court that the facts presented by the prosecution seem to warrant no leniency. The penalty which this court has the power to impose on you is extremely severe."
"Go ahead."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Impose it." The three judges looked at one another. Then their spokesman turned back to Reardon.
"This is unprecedented," he said.
"It is completely irregular," said the second judge. "The law requires you to submit a plea in your own defense. Your only alternative is to state for the record that you throw yourself upon the mercy of the court."
"I do not."
"But you have to." "Do you mean that what you expect from me is some sort of voluntary action?"
"Yes."
"I volunteer nothing."
"But the law demands that the defendant's side be represented on the record."
"Do you mean that you need my help to make this procedure legal?"
"Well, no. Yes. That is, to complete the form."
"I will not help you." The third and youngest judge, who had acted as prosecutor, snapped impatiently,
"This is ridiculous and unfair. Do you want to let it look as if a man of your prominence had been railroaded without a—"
He cut himself off short. Somebody at the back of the courtroom emitted a long whistle. "I want," said Reardon gravely, "to let the nature of this procedure appear exactly for what it is. If you need my help to disguise it, I will not help you."
"But we are giving you a chance to defend yourself, and it is you who are rejecting it."
"I will not help you to pretend that I have a chance. I will not help you to preserve an appearance of righteousness where rights are not recognized. I will not help you to preserve an appearance of rationality by entering a debate in which a gun is the final argument. I will not help you to pretend that you are administering justice."
"But the law compels you to volunteer a defense."
There was laughter at the back of the courtroom. "That is the flaw in your theory, gentlemen," said Reardon gravely, "and I will not help you out of it. If you choose to deal with men by means of compulsion, do so. But you will discover that you need the voluntary cooperation of your victims in many more ways than you can see at present. And your victims should discover that it is their own volition, which you cannot force, that makes you possible. I choose to be consistent, and I will obey you in the manner you demand. Whatever you wish me to do, I will do it at the point of a gun. If you sentence me to jail, you will have to send armed men to carry me there. I will not volunteer to move. If you fine me, you will have to seize my property to collect the fine. I will not volunteer to pay it. If you believe that you have the right to force me, use your guns openly. I will not help you to disguise the nature of your action. The eldest judge leaned forward across the table, and his voice became suavely derisive. You speak as if you were fighting for some sort of principle, Mr. Reardon, but what you're actually fighting for is only your property, isn't it? Yes, of course. I am fighting for my property. Do you know the kind of principle that represents? You pose as a champion of freedom, but it's only the freedom to make money that you're after. Yes, of course. All I want is the freedom to make money. Do you know what that freedom implies? Surely, Mr. Reardon, you wouldn't want your attitude to be misunderstood. You wouldn't want to give support to the widespread impression that you are a man devoid of social conscience, who feels no concern for the welfare of his fellows and works for nothing but his own profit. I work for nothing but my own profit. I earn it. There was a gasp, not of indignation, but of astonishment, in the crowd behind him, and silence from the judges he faced. He went on calmly. No. I do not want my attitude to be misunderstood. I shall be glad to state it for the record. I am in full agreement with the facts of everything said about me in the newspapers. With the facts, but not with the evaluation. I work for nothing but my own profit, which I make by selling a product they need to men who are willing and able to buy it. I do not produce it for their benefit at the expense of mine, and they do not buy it for my benefit at the expense of theirs. I do not sacrifice my interests to them, nor do they sacrifice theirs to me. We deal as equals by mutual consent to mutual advantage, and I am proud of every penny that I have earned in this manner. I am rich, and I am proud of every penny I own. I have made my money by my own effort, in free exchange and through the voluntary consent of every man I dealt with, the voluntary consent of those who employed me when I started, the voluntary consent of those who work for me now, the voluntary consent of those who buy my product. I shall answer all the questions you are afraid to ask me openly. Do I wish to pay my workers more than their services are worth to me? I do not. Do I wish to sell my product for less than my customers are willing to pay me? I do not. Do I wish to sell it at a loss or give it away? I do not. If this is evil, do whatever you please about me according to whatever standards you hold. These are mine. I am earning my own living, as every honest man must. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact of my own existence and the fact that I must work in order to support it. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact that I am able to do it and to do it well. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact that I am able to do it better than most people. The fact that my work is of greater value than the work of my neighbors, and that more men are willing to pay me. I refuse to apologize for my ability. I refuse to apologize for my success. I refuse to apologize for my money. If this is evil, make the most of it. If this is what the public finds harmful to its interests, let the public destroy me. This is my code, and I will accept no other. I could say to you that I have done more good for my fellow men than you can ever hope to accomplish, but I will not say it, because I do not seek the good of others as a sanction for my right to exist, nor do I recognize the good of others as a justification for their seizure of my property or their destruction of my life. I will not say that the good of others was the purpose of my work. My own good was my purpose, and I despise the man who surrenders his. I could say to you that you do not serve the public good, that nobody's good can be achieved at the price of human sacrifices, that when you violate the rights of one man, you have violated the rights of all, and a public of rightless creatures is doomed to destruction. I could say to you that you will and can achieve nothing but universal devastation, as any looter must when he runs out of victims. I could say it, but I won't. It is not your particular policy that I challenge, but your moral premise. If it were true that men could achieve their good by means of turning some men into sacrificial animals, and I were asked to immolate myself for the sake of creatures who wanted to survive at the price of my blood, if I were asked to serve the interests of society apart from, above, and against my own, I would refuse. I would reject it as the most contemptible evil. I would fight it with every power I possess. I would fight the whole of mankind. If 1 minute were all I could last before I were murdered, I would fight in the full confidence of the justice of my battle and of a living being's right to exist. Let there be no misunderstanding about me. If it is now the belief of my fellow men, who call themselves the public, that their good requires victims, then I say, the public good be damned. I will have no part of it. The crowd burst into applause. Reardon whirled around, more startled than his judges. He saw faces that laughed in violent excitement, and faces that pleaded for help. He saw their silent despair breaking out into the open. He saw the same anger and indignation as his own, finding release in a wild defiance of their cheering. He saw the looks of admiration and the looks of hope. There were also the faces of loose-mouthed young men and maliciously unkempt females, the kind who led the booing in newsreel theaters at any appearance of a businessman on the screen. They did not attempt a counter-demonstration. They were silent. As he looked at the crowd, people saw in his face what the threats of the judges had not been able to evoke, the first sign of emotion. It was a few moments before they heard the furious beating of a gavel upon the table and one of the judges yelling, "Or I shall have the courtroom cleared!" As he turned back to the table, Reardon's eyes moved over the visitor's section. His glance paused on Dagny, a pause perceptible only to her, as if he were saying, "It works." She would have appeared calm, except that her eyes seemed to have become too large for her face. Eddie Willers was smiling the kind of smile that is a man's substitute for breaking into tears. Mr. Moen looked stupefied. Paul Larkin was staring at the floor. There was no expression on Bertram Scudder's face, or on Lillian's. She sat at the end of a row, her legs crossed, a mink stole slanting from her right shoulder to her left hip. She looked at Reardon, not moving. In the complex violence of all the things he felt, he had time to recognize a touch of regret and of longing. There was a face he had hoped to see, had looked for from the start of the session, had wanted to be present more than any other face around him. But Francisco D'Anconia had not come. "Mr. Reardon," said the eldest judge, smiling affably, reproachfully, and spreading his arms, "it is regrettable that you should have misunderstood us so completely. That's the trouble, that businessmen refuse to approach us in a spirit of trust and friendship. They seem to imagine that we are their enemies.
Why do you speak of human sacrifices? What made you go to such an extreme? We have no intention of seizing your property or destroying your life. We do not seek to harm your interests. We are fully aware of your distinguished achievements. Our purpose is only to balance social pressures and do justice to all. This hearing is really intended not as a trial, but as a friendly discussion aimed at mutual understanding and cooperation.
I do not cooperate at the point of a gun.
Why speak of guns? This matter is not serious enough to warrant such references. We are fully aware that the guilt in this case lies chiefly with Mr. Kenneth Daniger, who instigated this infringement of the law, who exerted pressure upon you, and who confessed his guilt by disappearing in order to escape trial.
No, we did it by equal, mutual, voluntary agreement.
Mr. Reardon, said the second judge, you may not share some of our ideas, but when all is said and done, we're all working for the same cause, for the good of the people. We realize that you were prompted to disregard legal technicalities by the critical situation of the coal mines and the crucial importance of fuel to the public welfare.
No, I was prompted by my own profit and my own interests. What effect it had on the coal mines and the public welfare is for you to estimate. That was not my motive.
Mr. Moen stared dazedly about him and whispered to Paul Larkin, something's gone screwy here.
Oh, shut up, snapped Larkin.
I am sure, Mr. Reardon, said the eldest judge, that you do not really believe, nor does the public, that we wish to treat you as a sacrificial victim. If anyone has been laboring under such a misapprehension, we are anxious to prove that it is not true. The judges retired to consider their verdict. They did not stay out long. They returned to an ominously silent courtroom and announced that a fine of $5,000 was imposed on Henry Reardon, but that the sentence was suspended. Streaks of jeering laughter ran through the applause that swept the courtroom. The applause was aimed at Reardon, the laughter at the judges. Reardon stood motionless, not turning to the crowd, barely hearing the applause. He stood looking at the judges. There was no triumph in his face, no elation, only the still intensity of contemplating a vision with a bitter wonder that was almost fear. He was seeing the enormity of the smallness of the enemy who was destroying the world. He felt as if, after a journey of years through a landscape of devastation, past the ruins of great factories, the wrecks of powerful engines, the bodies of invincible men, he had come upon the despoiler, expecting to find a giant, and had found a rat, eager to scurry for cover at the first sound of a human step. If this is what has beaten us, he thought, the guilt is ours. He was jolted back into the courtroom by the people pressing to surround him. He smiled in answer to their smiles, to the frantic, tragic eagerness of their faces. There was a touch of sadness in his smile.
God bless you, Mr. Reardon, said an old woman with a ragged shawl over her head. Can't you save us, Mr. Reardon? They're eating us alive, and it's no use fooling anybody about how it's the rich that they're after. Do you know what's happening to us?
Listen, Mr. Reardon, said a man who looked like a factory worker. It's the rich who were selling us down the river. Tell those wealthy bastards who were so anxious to give everything away that when they give away their palaces, they're giving away the skin off our backs.
I know it, said Reardon. The guilt is ours, he thought. If we who were the movers, the providers, the benefactors of mankind, were willing to let the brand of evil be stamped upon us and silently to bear punishment for our virtues, what sort of good did we expect to triumph in the world?
He looked at the people around him. They had cheered him today. They had cheered him by the side of the track of the John Galt line.
but tomorrow they would clamor for a new directive from Wesley Mouch and a free housing project from Orrin Boyle, while Boyle's girders collapsed upon their heads. They would do it, because they would be told to forget, as a sin, that which had made them cheer Hank Reardon. Why were they ready to renounce their highest moments as a sin? Why were they willing to betray the best within them? What made them believe that this earth was a realm of evil where despair was their natural fate? He could not name the reason, but he knew that it had to be named. He felt it as a huge question mark within the courtroom, which it was now his duty to answer. This was the real sentence imposed upon him, he thought, to discover what idea, what simple idea available to the simplest man, had made mankind accept the doctrines that led it to self-destruction.
Hank, I'll never think that it's hopeless. Not ever again, said Dagny that evening after the trial. I'll never be tempted to quit. You've proved that the right always works and always wins.
She stopped, then added, provided one knows what is the right. Lillian said to him at dinner next day,
so you've won, have you?
Her voice was noncommittal. She said nothing else. She was watching him, as if studying a riddle. The wet nurse asked him at the mills,
Mr. Reardon, what's a moral premise?
What you're going to have a lot of trouble with. The boy frowned, then shrugged and said, laughing,
God, that was a wonderful show. What a beating you gave them, Mr. Reardon. I sat by the radio and howled.
How do you know it was a beating?
Well, it was, wasn't it?
Are you sure of it?
Sure, I'm sure.
The thing that makes you sure is a moral premise. The newspapers were silent. After the exaggerated attention they had given to the case, they acted as if the trial were not worthy of notice. They printed brief accounts on unlikely pages, worded in such generalities that no reader could discover any hint of a controversial issue. The businessmen he met seemed to wish to evade the subject of his trial. Some made no comment at all, but turned away, their faces showing a peculiar resentment under the effort to appear noncommittal, as if they feared that the mere act of looking at him would be interpreted as taking a stand. Others ventured to comment,
In my opinion, Reardon, it was extremely unwise of you. It seems to me that this is hardly the time to make enemies. We can't afford to arouse resentment.
Whose resentment? He asked.
I don't think the government will like it.
You saw the consequences of that.
Well, I don't know. The public won't take it. There's bound to be a lot of indignation.
You saw how the public took it.
Well, I don't know. We've been trying hard not to give any grounds for all those accusations about selfish greed, and you've given ammunition to the enemy.
Would you rather agree with the enemy that you have no right to your profits and your property?
Oh, no, no, certainly not. But why go to extremes? There's always a middle ground.
A middle ground between you and your murderers.
Now, why use such words?
What I said at the trial, was it true or not?
It's going to be misquoted and misunderstood.
Was it true or not?
The public is too dumb to grapple with such issues.
Was it true or not?
It's no time to boast about being rich. When the populace is starving, it's just goading them on to seize everything.
But telling them that you have no right to your wealth while they have is what's going to restrain them?
Well, I don't know.
I don't like the things you said at your trial, said another man. In my opinion, I don't agree with you at all. Personally, I'm proud to believe that I am working for the public good, not just for my own profit. I like to think that I have some goal higher than just earning my 3 meals a day and my Hammond limousine. And I don't like that idea about no directives and no controls, said another. I grant you they're running hog wild and overdoing it, but no controls at all? I don't go along with that. I think some controls are necessary, the ones which are for the public good.
"I am sorry, gentlemen," said Reardon, "that I will be obliged to save your goddamn necks along with mine." A group of businessmen headed by Mr. Moen did not issue any statements about the trial, but a week later they announced, with an inordinate amount of publicity, that they were endowing the construction of a playground for the children of the unemployed. Bertram Scudder did not mention the trial in his column, but 10 days later he wrote, among items of miscellaneous gossip, "Some idea of the public value of Mr. Hank Reardon may be gathered from the fact that of all social groups, he seems to be most unpopular with his own fellow businessmen. His old-fashioned brand of ruthlessness seems to be too much even for those predatory barons of profit." On an evening in December, when the street beyond his window was like a congested throat, coughing with the horns of pre-Christmas traffic, Reardon sat in his room at the Wayne Falkland Hotel, fighting an enemy more dangerous than weariness or fear, revulsion against the thought of having to deal with human beings. He sat, unwilling to venture into the streets of the city, unwilling to move, as if he were chained to his chair and to this room. He had tried for hours to ignore an emotion that felt like the pull of homesickness, his awareness that the only man whom he longed to see was here in this hotel, just a few floors above him. He had caught himself in the past few weeks, wasting time in the lobby whenever he entered the hotel or left it, loitering unnecessarily at the mail counter or the newsstand, watching the hurried currents of people hoping to see Francisco D'Anconia among them. He had caught himself eating solitary dinners in the restaurant of the Wayne Falkland, with his eyes on the curtains of the entrance doorway. Now he caught himself sitting in his room, thinking that the distance was only a few floors. He rose to his feet with a chuckle of amused indignation. He was acting, he thought, like a woman who waits for a telephone call and fights against the temptation to end the torture by making the first move. There was no reason, he thought, why he could not go to Francisco D'Anconia, if that was what he wanted. Yet when he told himself that he would, he felt some dangerous element of surrender in the intensity of his own relief. He made a step toward the phone to call Francisco's suite, but stopped. It was not what he wanted. What he wanted was simply to walk in unannounced, as Francisco had walked into his office. It was this that seemed to state some unstated right between them. On his way to the elevator, he thought, he won't be in, or if he is, you'll probably find him entertaining some floozy which will serve you right. But the thought seemed unreal. He could not make it apply to the man he had seen at the mouth of the furnace. He stood confidently in the elevator looking up. He walked confidently down the hall, feeling his bitterness relax into gaiety. He knocked at the door. Francisco's voice snapped, "Come in." It had a brusque, absent-minded sound. Reardon opened the door and stopped on the threshold. One of the hotel's costliest satin-shaded lamps stood in the middle of the floor, throwing a circle of light on wide sheets of drafting paper. Francisco D'Anconia, in shirt sleeves, a strand of hair hanging down over his face, lay stretched on the floor on his stomach, propped up by his elbows, biting the end of a pencil in concentration upon some point of the intricate tracing before him. He did not look up. He seemed to have forgotten the knock. Reardon tried to distinguish the drawing. It looked like the section of a smelter. He stood watching in startled wonder. Had he had the power to bring into reality his own image of Francisco D'Anconia, this was the picture he would have seen. The figure of a purposeful young worker intent upon a difficult task. In a moment Francisco raised his head. In the next instant he flung his body upward to a kneeling posture, looking at Reardon with a smile of incredulous pleasure. In the next, he seized the drawings and threw them aside too hastily, face down. "What did I interrupt?" asked Reardon. "Nothing much. Come in." He was grinning happily. Reardon felt suddenly certain that Francisco had waited, too, had waited for this as for a victory which he had not quite hoped to achieve. "What were you doing?" asked Reardon.
"Just amusing myself."
"Let me see it."
"No."
He rose and kicked the drawings aside.
Reardon noted that if he had resented as impertinence Francisco's manner of proprietorship in his office, he himself was now guilty of the same attitude, because he offered no explanation for his visit, but crossed the room and sat down in an armchair casually, as if he were at home. "Why didn't you come to continue what you had started?" he asked.
"You have been continuing it brilliantly without my help."
"Do you mean my trial?"
"I mean your trial."
"How do you know?" "You weren't there." Francisco smiled, because the tone of the voice confessed an added sentence. "I was looking for you."
"Don't you suppose I heard every word of it on the radio?"
"You did. Well, how did you like hearing your own lines come over the air with me as your stooge?"
"They weren't, Mr. Reardon. They weren't my lines. Weren't they the things you had always lived by?"
"Yes."
"I only helped you to see that you should have been proud to live by them."
"I am glad you heard it."
"It was great, Mr. Reardon. And about 3 generations too late."
"What do you mean?"
"If one single businessman had had the courage then to say that he worked for nothing but his own profit, and to say it proudly, he would have saved the world."
"I haven't given up the world as lost."
"It isn't. It never can be. But, oh God, what he would have spared us."
"Well, I guess we have to fight, no matter what era we're caught in."
"Yes. You know, Mr. Reardon, I would suggest that you get a transcript of your trial and read what you said. Then see whether you are practicing it fully and consistently or not."
"You mean that I'm not?"
"See for yourself."
"I know that you had a great deal to tell me when we were interrupted that night at the mills. Why don't you finish what you had to say?"
"No. It's too soon."
Francisco acted as if there were nothing unusual about this visit, as if he took it as a matter of natural course, as he had always acted in Reardon's presence. But Reardon noted that he was not so calm as he wished to appear. He was pacing the room in a manner that seemed a release for an emotion he did not want to confess. He had forgotten the lamp, and it still stood on the floor as the room's sole illumination.
"You've been taking an awful beating in the way of discoveries, haven't you?"
said Francisco.
"How did you like the behavior of your fellow businessmen?"
"I suppose it was to be expected." His voice, tense with the anger of compassion, Francisco said,
"It's been 12 years, and yet I'm still unable to see it indifferently."
The sentence sounded involuntary, as if, trying to suppress the sound of emotion, he had uttered suppressed words.
12 years. Since what?" asked Reardon.
There was an instant's pause, but Francisco answered calmly,
"Since I understood what those men were doing."
He added, "I know what you're going through right now, and what's still ahead."
"Thanks," said Reardon.
"For what?"
"For what you're trying so hard not to show. But don't worry about me. I'm still able to stand it. You know, I didn't come here because I wanted to talk about myself or even about the trial."
"I'll agree to any subject you choose in order to have you here."
He said it in the tone of a courteous joke, but the tone could not disguise it. He meant it.
"What did you want to talk about?"
"You."
Francisco stopped. He looked at Reardon for a moment, then answered quietly,
"All right."
If that which Reardon felt could have gone directly into words, past the barrier of his will, he would have cried, "Don't let me down. I need you. I am fighting all of them. I have fought to my limit and am condemned to fight beyond it. And as sole ammunition possible to me, I need the knowledge of one single man whom I can trust, respect, and admire."
Instead, he said calmly, very simply,
and the only note of a personal bond between them was that tone of sincerity which comes with a direct, unqualifiedly rational statement and implies the same honesty of mind in the listener. You know, I think that the only real moral crime that one man can commit against another is the attempt to create, by his words or actions, an impression of the contradictory, the impossible, the irrational, and thus shake the concept of rationality in his victim.
That's true.
If I say that that is the dilemma you've put me in, would you help me by answering a personal question?
I will try.
I don't have to tell you. I think you know it, that you are the man of the highest mind I have ever met. I am coming to accept, not as right, but at least as possible, the fact that you refuse to exercise your great ability in the world of today. But what a man does out of despair is not necessarily a key to his character. I have always thought that the real key is in that which he seeks for his enjoyment. And this is what I find inconceivable. No matter what you've given up, so long as you chose to remain alive, how can you find any pleasure in spending a life as valuable as yours on running after cheap women and on an imbecile's idea of diversions? Francisco looked at him with a fine smile of amusement, as if saying, "No, you didn't want to talk about yourself? And what is it that you're confessing but the desperate loneliness which makes the question of my character more important to you than any other question right now?" The smile merged into a soft, good-natured chuckle, as if the question involved no problem for him, no painful secret to reveal.
"There's a way to solve every dilemma of that kind, Mr. Reardon. Check your premises."
He sat down on the floor, settling himself gaily, informally, for a conversation he would enjoy. "Is it your own first-hand conclusion that I am a man of high mind?"
"Yes."
"Do you know of your own first-hand knowledge that I spend my life running after women?"
"You've never denied it."
"Denied it?
I've gone to a lot of trouble to create that impression."
"Do you mean to say that it isn't true?"
"Do I strike you as a man with a miserable inferiority complex?"
"Good God, no. Only that kind of man spends his life running after women."
"What do you mean?"
"Do you remember what I said about money and about the men who seek to reverse the law of cause and effect? The men who try to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind? The man who despises himself tries to gain self-esteem from sexual adventures, which can't be done, because sex is not the cause, but an effect, and an expression of a man's sense of his own value."
"You'd better explain that."
"Did it ever occur to you that it's the same issue? The men who think that wealth comes from material resources and has no intellectual root or meaning are the men who think, for the same reason, that sex is a physical capacity which functions independently of one's mind, choice, or code of values. They think that your body creates a desire and makes a choice for you, just about in some such way as if iron ore transformed itself into railroad rails of its own volition. Love is blind, they say. Sex is impervious to reason and mocks the power of all philosophers. But in fact, a man's sexual choice is the result and the sum of his fundamental convictions. Tell me what a man finds sexually attractive, and I will tell you his entire philosophy of life.
Show me the woman he sleeps with, and I will tell you his valuation of himself. No matter what corruption he's taught about the virtue of selflessness, sex is the most profoundly selfish of all acts, an act which he cannot perform for any motive but his own enjoyment. Just try to think of performing it in a spirit of selfless charity, an act which is not possible in self-abasement, only in self-exaltation, only in the confidence of being desired and being worthy of desire.
It is an act that forces him to stand naked in spirit as well as in body, and to accept his real ego as his standard of value. He will always be attracted to the woman who reflects his deepest vision of himself, the woman whose surrender permits him to experience, or to fake, a sense of self-esteem. The man who is proudly certain of his own value will want the highest type of woman he can find, the woman he admires, the strongest, the hardest to conquer. Because only the possession of a heroine will give him the sense of an achievement, not the possession of a brainless slut. He does not seek to... What's the matter? He asked, seeing the look on Reardon's face, a look of intensity much beyond mere interest in an abstract discussion. Go on, said Reardon tensely. He does not seek to gain his value. He seeks to express it. There is no conflict between the standards of his mind and the desires of his body. But the man who is convinced of his own worthlessness will be drawn to a woman he despises, because she will reflect his own secret self. She will release him from that objective reality in which he is a fraud. She will give him a momentary illusion of his own value and a momentary escape from the moral code that damns him. Observe the ugly mess which most men make of their sex lives, and observe the mess of contradictions which they hold as their moral philosophy. One proceeds from the other. Love is our response to our highest values, and can be nothing else. Let a man corrupt his values and his view of existence. Let him profess that love is not self-enjoyment but self-denial, that virtue consists not of pride but of pity or pain or weakness or sacrifice, that the noblest love is born not of admiration but of charity, not in response to values, but in response to flaws, and he will have cut himself in two. His body will not obey him. It will not respond. It will make him impotent toward the woman he professes to love and draw him to the lowest type of whore he can find. His body will always follow the ultimate logic of his deepest convictions. If he believes that flaws are values, he has damned existence as evil, and only the evil will attract him. He has damned himself, and he will feel that depravity is all he is worthy of enjoying. He has equated virtue with pain, and he will feel that vice is the only realm of pleasure. Then he will scream that his body has vicious desires of its own, which his mind cannot conquer, that sex is sin, that true love is a pure emotion of the spirit. And then he will wonder why love brings him nothing but boredom, and sex nothing but shame. Reardon said slowly, looking off, not realizing that he was thinking aloud, "At least, I've never accepted that other tenet. I've never felt guilty about making money." Francisco missed the significance of the first two words. He smiled and said eagerly, "You do see that it's the same issue. No, you'd never accept any part of their vicious creed. You wouldn't be able to force it upon yourself. If you tried to damn sex as evil, you'd still find yourself against your will, acting on the proper moral premise. You'd be attracted to the highest woman you met. You'd always want a heroine. You'd be incapable of self-contempt. You'd be unable to believe that existence is evil and that you're a helpless creature caught in an impossible universe. You're the man who's spent his life shaping matter to the purpose of his mind. You're the man who would know that just as an idea unexpressed in physical action is contemptible hypocrisy, so is platonic love. And just as physical action unguided by an idea is a fool's self-fraud, so is sex when cut off from one's code of values. It's the same issue, and you would know it. Your inviolate sense of self-esteem would know it. You would be incapable of desire for a woman you despised.
Only the man who extols the purity of a love devoid of desire is capable of the depravity of a desire devoid of love. But observe that most people are creatures cut in half, who keep swinging desperately to one side or to the other. One kind of half is the man who despises money, factories, skyscrapers, and his own body. He holds undefined emotions about non-conceivable subjects as the meaning of life and as his claim to virtue. And he cries with despair because he can feel nothing for the women he respects, but finds himself in bondage to an irresistible passion for a slut from the gutter. He is the man whom people call an idealist. The other kind of half is the man whom people call practical, the man who despises principles, abstractions, art, philosophy, and his own mind. He regards the acquisition of material objects as the only goal of existence, and he laughs at the need to consider their purpose or their source. He expects them to give him pleasure, and he wonders why the more he gets, the less he feels. He is the man who spends his time chasing women. Observe the triple fraud which he perpetrates upon himself. He will not acknowledge his need of self-esteem, since he scoffs at such a concept as moral values. Yet he feels the profound self-contempt which comes from believing that he is a piece of meat. He will not acknowledge, but he knows that sex is the physical expression of a tribute to personal values. So he tries, by going through the motions of the effect, to acquire that which should have been the cause. He tries to gain a sense of his own value from the women who surrender to him. And he forgets that the women he picks have neither character nor judgment nor standard of value. He tells himself that all he's after is physical pleasure. But observe that he tires of his women in a week or a night, that he despises professional whores, and that he loves to imagine he is seducing virtuous girls who make a great exception for his sake. It is the feeling of achievement that he seeks and never finds. What glory can there be in the conquest of a mindless body? Now that is your woman chaser. Does the description fit me?
God, no.
Then you can judge, without asking my word for it, how much chasing of women I've done in my life.
But what on earth have you been doing on the front pages of newspapers for the last, isn't it, 12 years?
I've spent a lot of money on the most ostentatiously vulgar parties I could think of, and a miserable amount of time on being seen with the appropriate sort of women. As for the rest, he stopped, then said, I have some friends who know this, but you are the first person to whom I am confiding it against my own rules. I have never slept with any of those women. I have never touched one of them. What is more incredible than that is that I believe you.
The lamp on the floor beside him threw broken bits of light across Francisco's face as he leaned forward. The face had a look of guiltless amusement.
If you care to glance over those front pages, you'll see that I've never said anything. It was the women who were eager to rush into print with stories insinuating that being seen with me at a restaurant was the sign of a great romance. What do you suppose those women are after but the same thing as the chaser, the desire to gain their own value from the number and fame of the men they conquer? Only it's one step phonier, because the value they seek is not even in the actual act, but in the impression on and the envy of other women. Well, I gave those bitches what they wanted. But what they literally wanted, without the pretense that they expected, the pretense that hides from them the nature of their wish. Do you think they wanted to sleep with me, or with any man? They wouldn't be capable of so real and honest a desire. They wanted food for their vanity, and I gave it to them.
I gave them the chance to boast to their friends and to see themselves in the scandal sheets in the roles of great seductresses. But do you know that it works in exactly the same way as what you did at your trial? If you want to defeat any kind of vicious fraud, comply with it literally, adding nothing of your own to disguise its nature. Those women understood. They saw whether there's any satisfaction in being envied by others for a feat one has not achieved. Instead of self-esteem, their publicized romances with me have given them a deeper sense of inferiority. Each one of them knows that she's tried and failed. If dragging me into bed is supposed to be her public standard of value, she knows that she couldn't live up to it. I think those women hate me more than any other man on earth. But my secret is safe, because each one of them thinks that she was the only one who failed, while all the others succeeded. So she'll be the more vehement in swearing to our romance, and will never admit the truth to anybody. But what have you done to your own reputation? Francisco shrugged. Those whom I respect will know the truth about me sooner or later. The others... His face hardened. The others consider that which I really am as evil. Let them have what they prefer, what I appear to be on the front pages. But what for? Why did you do it? Just to teach them a lesson? Hell no. I wanted to be known as a playboy. Why? A playboy is a man who just can't help letting money run through his fingers. Why did you want to assume such an ugly sort of role? Camouflage. For what? For a purpose of my own. What purpose? Francisco shook his head. Don't ask me to tell you that. I've told you more than I should. You'll come to know the rest of it soon, anyway. If it's more than you should, why did you tell me? Because... you've made me become impatient for the first time in years. The note of a suppressed emotion came back into his voice. Because I've never wanted anyone to know the truth about me as I wanted you to know it. Because I knew that you'd despise a playboy more than any other sort of man, as I would too. Playboy? I've never loved but one woman in my life, and still do and always will. It was an involuntary break, and he added, his voice low, I've never confessed that to anyone. Not even to her. Have you lost her? Francisco sat looking off into space. In a moment he answered tonelessly, I hope not. The light of the lamp hid his face from below, and Reardon could not see his eyes, only his mouth drawn in lines of endurance and oddly solemn resignation. Reardon knew that this was a wound not to be probed any further. With one of his swift changes of mood, Francisco said, Oh, well, it's just a little longer, and rose to his feet, smiling. Since you trust me, said Reardon, I want to tell you a secret of mine in exchange. I want you to know how much I trusted you before I came here, and I might need your help later. You're the only man left whom I'd like to help. There's a great deal that I don't understand about you, but I'm certain of one thing, that you're not a friend of the looters. I'm not. There was a hint of amusement in Francisco's face, as at an understatement. So I know that you won't betray me if I tell you that I'm going to continue selling Reardon metal to customers of my own choice in any amount I wish, whenever I see a chance to do it. Right now, I'm getting ready to pour an order 20 times the size of the one they tried me for. Sitting on the arm of a chair a few feet away, Francisco leaned forward to look at him silently, frowning for a long moment. Do you think that you're fighting them by doing it? He asked. Well, what would you call it? Cooperating?
You were willing to work and produce Reardon metal for them at the price of losing your profits, losing your friends, enriching stray bastards who had the pull to rob you, and taking their abuse for the privilege of keeping them alive. Now you're willing to do it at the price of accepting the position of a criminal and the risk of being thrown in jail at any moment, for the sake of keeping in existence a system which can be kept going only by its victims. Only by the breaking of its own laws.
It's not for their systems, but for customers whom I can't abandon to the mercy of their system. I intend to outlast that system of theirs. I don't intend to let them stop me, no matter how hard they make it for me, and I don't intend to give up the world to them, even if I am the last man left. Right now, that illegal order is more important to me than the whole of my mills. Francisco shook his head slowly and did not answer. Then he asked,
To which one of your friends in the copper industry are you going to give the valuable privilege of informing on you this time?
Reardon smiled. Not this time. This time I'm dealing with a man I can trust.
Really? Who is it?
You. Francisco sat up straight.
What?
He asked, his voice so low that he almost succeeded in hiding the sound of a gasp. Reardon was smiling. You didn't know that I'm one of your customers now. It was done through a couple of stooges and under a phony name. But I'll need your help to prevent anyone on your staff from becoming inquisitive about it. I need that copper. I need it on time. And I don't care if they arrest me later, so long as I get this through. I know that you've lost all concern for your company, your wealth, your work, because you don't care to deal with looters like Taggart and Boyle. But if you meant all the things you taught me, if I am the last man left whom you respect, you'll help me to survive and to beat them. I've never asked for anyone's help. I'm asking for yours. I need you. I trust you. You've always professed your admiration for me. Well, there's my life in your hands, if you want it. An order of Danconia copper is being shipped to me right now. It left San Juan on December 5th.
What?
It was a scream of plain shock. Francisco had shot to his feet, past any attempt to hide anything.
On December 5th?
Yes, said Reardon, stupefied. Francisco leaped to the telephone.
I told you not to deal with Danconia copper.
It was the half-moaning, half-furious cry of despair. His hand was reaching for the telephone, but jerked back. He grasped the edge of the table, as if to stop himself from lifting the receiver, and he stood head down, for how long a time neither he nor Reardon could tell. Reardon was held numb by the fact of watching an agonized struggle with the motionless figure of a man as its only evidence. He could not guess the nature of the struggle, but he knew only that there was something which Francisco had the power to prevent in that moment, and that it was a power which he would not use. When Francisco raised his head, Reardon saw a face drawn by so great a suffering that its lines were almost an audible cry of pain, the more terrible because the face had a look of firmness, as if the decision had been made, and this was the price of it. Francisco, what's the matter?
Hank, I...
He shook his head, stopped, then stood up straight.
Mr. Reardon,
he said, in a voice that had the strength, the despair, and the peculiar dignity of a plea he knew to be hopeless.
For the time when you're going to damn me, when you're going to doubt every word I said, I swear to you, by the woman I love, that I am your friend.
The memory of Francisco's face as it looked in that moment came back to Reardon 3 days later through a blinding shock of loss and hatred. It came back even though, standing by the radio in his office, he thought that he must now keep away from the Wayne Falkland or he would kill Francisco Danconia on sight. It kept coming back to him through the words he was hearing.
he was hearing that 3 ships of Danconia copper, bound from San Juan to New York, had been attacked by Ragnar Danneskiold and sent to the bottom of the ocean. It kept coming back, even though he knew that much more than the copper had gone down for him with those ships.
Chapter 5. Account Overdrawn. It was the first failure in the history of Reardon Steel. For the first time, an order was not delivered as promised. But by February 15th, when the Taggart rail was due, it made no difference to anyone any longer. Winter had come early in the last days of November. People said that it was the hardest winter on record and that no one could be blamed for the unusual severity of the snowstorms. They did not care to remember that there had been a time when snowstorms did not sweep unresisted down unlighted roads and upon the roofs of unheated houses, did not stop the movement of trains, did not leave a wake of corpses counted by the hundreds. The first time that Danniger Coal was late in delivering fuel to Taggart Transcontinental, in the last week of December, Danniger's cousin explained that he could not help it. He had had to cut the workday down to 6 hours, he said, in order to raise the morale of the men who did not seem to function as they had in the days of his cousin Kenneth. The men had become listless and sloppy, he said, because they were exhausted by the harsh discipline of the former management. He could not help it if some of the superintendents and foremen had quit him without reason, men who had been with the company for 10 to 20 years. He could not help it if there seemed to be some friction between his workers and his new supervisory staff, even though the new men were much more liberal than the old slave drivers. It was only a matter of readjustment, he said. He could not help it, he said, if the tonnage intended for Taggart Transcontinental had been turned over on the eve of its scheduled delivery to the Bureau of Global Relief for shipment to the People's State of England. It was an emergency. The people of England were starving, with all of their state factories closing down, and Miss Taggart was being unreasonable, since it was only a matter of 1 day's delay. It was only 1 day's delay. It caused a 3 days delay in the run of freight train number 386, bound from California to New York with 59 carloads of lettuce and oranges. Freight train number 386 waited on sidings at coaling stations for the fuel that had not arrived. When the train reached New York, the lettuce and oranges had to be dumped into the East River. They had waited their turn too long in the freight houses of California, with the train schedules cut and the engines forbidden by directive to pull a train of more than 60 cars. Nobody but their friends and trade associates noticed that 3 orange growers in California went out of business, as well as 2 lettuce farmers in Imperial Valley. Nobody noticed the closing of a commission house in New York, of a plumbing company to which the commission house owed money, of a lead pipe wholesaler who had supplied the plumbing company. When people were starving, said the newspapers, one did not have to feel concern over the failures of business enterprises, which were only private ventures for private profit. The coal shipped across the Atlantic by the Bureau of Global Relief did not reach the People's State of England. It was seized by Ragnar Danneskiold. The second time that Danniger Coal was late in delivering fuel to Taggart Transcontinental in mid-January, Danniger's cousin snarled over the telephone that he could not help it. His mines had been shut down for 3 days due to a shortage of lubricating oil for the machinery. The supply of coal to Taggart Transcontinental was 4 days late. Mr. Quinn, of the Quinn Ball Bearing Company, which had once moved from Connecticut to Colorado, waited a week for the freight train that carried his order of Reardon Steel. When the train arrived, the doors of the Quinn Ball Bearing Company's plant were closed. Nobody traced the closing of a motor company in Michigan that had waited for a shipment of ball bearings, its machinery idle, its workers on full pay, or the closing of a sawmill in Oregon that had waited for a new motor, or the closing of a lumber yard in Iowa left without supply,
or the bankruptcy of a building contractor in Illinois who, failing to get his lumber on time, found his contracts canceled and the purchasers of his homes sent wandering off down snow-swept roads in search of that which did not exist anywhere any longer. The snowstorm that came at the end of January blocked the passes through the Rocky Mountains, raising white walls 30 feet high across the mainline track of Taggart Transcontinental. The men who attempted to clear the track gave up within the first few hours. The rotary plows broke down, one after another. The plows had been kept in precarious repair for 2 years past the span of their usefulness. The new plows had not been delivered. The manufacturer had quit, unable to obtain the steel he needed from Orrin Boyle. 3 westbound trains were trapped on the sidings of Winston Station, high in the Rockies, where the main line of Taggart Transcontinental cut across the northwest corner of Colorado. For 5 days, they remained beyond the reach of help. Trains could not approach them through the storm. The last of the trucks made by Lawrence Hammond broke down on the frozen grades of the mountain highways. The best of the airplanes once made by Dwight Sanders were sent out, but never reached Winston Station. They were worn past the stage of fighting a storm. Through the driving mesh of snow, the passengers trapped aboard the trains looked out at the lights of Winston's shanties. The lights died in the night of the second day. By the evening of the third, the lights, the heat, and the food had given out aboard the trains. In the brief lulls of the storm, when the white mesh vanished and left behind it the stillness of a black void merging a lightless earth with a starless sky, the passengers could see, many miles away to the south, a small tongue of flame twisting in the wind. It was Wyatt's torch. By the morning of the sixth day, when the trains were able to move and proceeded down the slopes of Utah, of Nevada, of California, the trainmen observed the smokeless stacks and the closed doors of small trackside factories, which had not been closed on their last run. "Storms are an act of God," wrote Bertram Scudder, "and nobody can be held socially responsible for the weather." The rations of coal established by Wesley Mouch permitted the heating of homes for 3 hours a day. There was no wood to burn, no metal to make new stoves, no tools to pierce the walls of the houses for new installations. In makeshift contraptions of bricks and oil cans, professors were burning the books of their libraries, and fruit growers were burning the trees of their orchards. "Privations strengthen a people's spirit," wrote Bertram Scudder, "and forge the fine steel of social discipline. Sacrifice is the cement which unites human bricks into the great edifice of society." The nation which had once held the creed that greatness is achieved by production is now told that it is achieved by squalor, said Francisco D'Anconia in a press interview. But this was not printed. The only business boom that winter came to the amusement industry. People wrenched their pennies out of the quicksands of their food and heat budgets and went without meals in order to crowd into movie theaters, in order to escape for a few hours the state of animals reduced to the single concern of terror over their crudest needs. In January, all movie theaters, nightclubs, and bowling alleys were closed by order of Wesley Mouch for the purpose of conserving fuel. "Pleasure is not an essential of existence," wrote Bertram Scudder. "You must learn to take a philosophical attitude," said Dr. Simon Pritchett to a young girl student who broke down into sudden hysterical sobs in the middle of a lecture. She had just returned from a volunteer relief expedition to a settlement on Lake Superior. She had seen a mother holding the body of a grown son who had died of hunger. "There are no absolutes," said Dr. Pritchett. "Reality is only an illusion. How does that woman know that her son is dead? How does she know that he ever existed?" People with pleading eyes and desperate faces crowded into tents where evangelists cried in triumphant gloating that man was unable to cope with nature, that his science was a fraud, that his mind was a failure, that he was reaping punishment for the sin of pride, for his confidence in his own intellect,
and that only faith in the power of mystic secrets could protect him from the fissure of a rail or from the blowout of the last tire on his last truck. Love was the key to the mystic secrets, they cried. Love and selfless sacrifice to the needs of others. Orrin Boyle made a selfless sacrifice to the needs of others. He sold to the Bureau of Global Relief for shipment to the People's State of Germany 10,000 tons of structural steel shapes that had been intended for the Atlantic Southern Railroad. It was a difficult decision to make, he said, with a moist, unfocused look of righteousness to the panic-stricken president of the Atlantic Southern. But I weighed the fact that you're a rich corporation, while the people of Germany are in a state of unspeakable misery. So I acted on the principle that need comes first. When in doubt, it's the weak that must be considered, not the strong. The president of the Atlantic Southern had heard that Orrin Boyle's most valuable friend in Washington had a friend in the Ministry of Supply of the People's State of Germany. But whether this had been Boyle's motive or whether it had been the principle of sacrifice, no one could tell, and it made no difference. If Boyle had been a saint of the creed of selflessness, he would have had to do precisely what